they were important. I knew they mattered. "I think you should do your movie," she said. "Finish strong, and then?" "And then after that, I think we should move to the coast of Spain."
"What?"
"I have always liked the idea of spending the last years of my life on a beautiful beach, with the love of a good woman," she said.
You're dying?"
"I can look into some locations in Spain while you're shooting. I'll find a place where Connor can get a great education. I'll sell my home here. I'll get a compound somewhere with enough space for Harry, too. And Robert."
"Your brother Robert?"
Celia nodded. "He moved out here for business a few years ago. We've become close. He knows who I am. He supports me."
"What is chronic obstructive?"
"Emphysema, more or less," she said, "from smoking." "Do you still smoke? You should stop right now." I shook my head, having long ago given it up. "They have treatments to slow down the process. I can live a normal life for the most part for a while."
"And then what?"
"And then eventually it will become difficult to be active, hard to breathe. When that happens, I won't have much time. All told, we're looking at 10 years, give or take, if I'm lucky."
10 years? You're only 49.
"I know."
I started crying. I couldn't help it.
"You're making a scene," she said. "You have to stop."
"I can't," I said.
"Okay," she said, "okay." She picked up her purse and threw down a $100 bill. She pulled me out of my chair and we walked to the valet. She gave him her ticket. She put me in the front seat of the car. She drove me to her house. She sat me on the sofa. "Can you handle this?" she said.
"What do you mean?" I asked her. "Of course I can't handle it."
"If you can handle this," she said, "then we can do this. We can be together. I think we can spend the rest of our lives together, Evelyn, if you can handle this. But I can't in good conscience do this to you if you don't think you'll survive it."
"Survive what exactly?"
"Losing me again. I don't want to let you love me if you don't think you can lose me again one last time."
"I can't, of course I can't.
But I want to anyway. I'm going to anyway." "Yes," I said finally. "I can survive it. I'd rather survive it than never feel it."
"Are you sure?" she said.
"Yes," I said. "Yes, I'm sure. I've never been more sure about anything. I love you, Celia. I've always loved you. And we should spend the rest of the time we have together." She grabbed my face, she kissed me, and I wept. She started crying with me, and soon I couldn't tell whether the tears I was tasting were hers or mine. All I knew was that I was once again in the arms of the woman I was always meant to love. Eventually, Celia's blouse was on the floor and my dress was hiked up around my thighs. I could feel her lips on my chest, her hands on my stomach. I stepped out of my dress. Her sheets were stark white and perfectly soft. She no longer smelled like cigarettes and alcohol, but like citrus. In the morning, I woke up with her hair in my face, fanned across the pillow. I rolled to my side and curved my body against the back of hers. "Here's what we're going to do," Celia said. "You're going to leave Max. I'm going to call a friend of mine in Congress. He's a representative from Vermont. He needs some press. You're going to be seen around with him. We're going to spread a rumor that you're stepping out on Max with a younger man."
"How old is he?"
29. "Jesus, Celia, he's a child," I said. "That's exactly what people will say. They'll be shocked that you're dating him. And when Max tries to slander me, it won't matter what he's trying to claim about you. It will look like he's just bitter."
"And then," I asked,
"and then, down the line, you marry my brother." "Why am I going to marry Robert?" "So that when I die, everything I own will be yours. My estate will be under your control, and you can keep my legacy." You could appoint that to me? And have someone try to take it away because you were my lover? No, this is better. This is smarter. But marrying your brother? Are you crazy? He'll do it, she said, for me. And because he's a rake who likes to bed almost every woman he sees, you'd be good for his reputation. It's a win-win. All this instead of just telling the truth. I could feel Celia's ribcage expand and contract underneath me. We can't tell the truth. Did you see what they did to Rock Hudson? If it was cancer he was dying of, there'd be telethons. People don't understand AIDS, I said. They understand it just fine, Celia said. They just think that he deserves it because of how he got it. I rested my head on the pillow while my heart sank in my chest. She was right, of course. The past few years, I'd watched Harry lose friend after friend, former lovers, to AIDS. I'd watch him cry his eyes red out of fear that he'd get sick, for not knowing how to help the people he loved. And I'd watched Ronald Reagan never so much as acknowledge what was happening in front of our eyes. I know things have changed since the 60s, she said, but they haven't changed that much. It wasn't that long ago that Reagan said gay rights weren't civil rights. You can't risk losing Connor. So I'll call Jack, my friend in the House of Representatives. We'll plant the story. You'll shoot your movie. You'll marry my brother. And we'll all move to Spain. I'll have to talk to Harry. Of course, she said, talk to Harry. If he hates Spain, we'll go to Germany or Scandinavia or Asia. I don't care. We just need to go somewhere where people won't care who we are, where people will leave us alone, and Connor can live a normal childhood. You'll need medical care. I'll fly where I need to, or we can bring people to me. I thought about it. It's a good plan. Yeah? Celia was flattered. I could tell. The student has become the master, I said. She laughed, and I kissed her. We're home, I said. This wasn't my home. We'd never lived here together before. But she knew what I meant. Yes, she said. We're home.
Now this. July 1st, 1988. Evelyn Hugo and Max Girard divorce turns ugly amid reports of Hugo cheating. Evelyn Hugo is headed to divorce court one more time. She filed papers citing irreconcilable differences this week, and while she's an old hand at this, it looks like this one's gonna be a doozy. Sources say Max Girard is seeking spousal support, and reports have surfaced claiming that Girard is bad-mouthing Hugo all over town. He's so angry he's saying just about anything he can to get back at her, an insider close to the former couple says. You name it, he's said it. She's a cheater. She's a lesbian. She owes him her Oscar. It's clear he's very heartbroken. Hugo was recently seen out with a much younger man last week. Jack Easton, a Democratic congressman from Vermont, is only 29 years old. That's more than two decades younger than Evelyn. And if the photos of their evening together out to dinner in Los Angeles are any indication, it looks like a blossoming romance. Hugo doesn't have a great track record, but in this case, it seems like one thing is clear. Girard's comments certainly sound like sour grapes.
Harry wasn't on board. He was the one piece of the plan that wasn't up to me, the one person I wasn't willing to manipulate into doing what I wanted him to do. And he didn't want to leave everything behind and fly off to Europe. You're suggesting I retire, Harry said. And I'm not even 60 yet. My God, Evelyn, what on earth am I going to do all day? Play cards on the beach? That doesn't sound nice. It sounds nice for about an hour and a half, he said. He was drinking what looked like orange juice, but I suspected was a screwdriver. And then I'd be stuck trying to occupy myself for the rest of my life. We were sitting in my dressing room on the set of Teresa's Wisdom. Harry had found the script and sold it to Fox with me attached to play Teresa, a woman who is leaving her husband while desperately trying to keep her children together. It was the third day of shooting, and I was in costume, a white Chanel pantsuit and pearls, about to go on set to shoot the scene where Teresa and her husband announced that they are divorcing over Christmas dinner. Harry looked as handsome as ever in khaki slacks and an Oxford shirt. He had gone almost entirely gray by then, and I actively resented him for growing more attractive as he aged, while I had to watch my value disappear by the day like a molding lemon. "Harry, don't you want to stop living this lie?"
"What lie?" he asked. "I understand it's a lie for you because you want to make it work with Celia, and you know that I support that, I do. But this life isn't a lie for me."
"There are men," I said, my voice losing patience, as if Harry was trying to pull one over on me. "Don't pretend there aren't men."
"Sure, but there is not a single man anyone could draw any sort of meaningful connection to," Harry said, "because I have only loved John, and he's gone. I'm only famous because you're famous, Ev. They don't care about me or what I'm doing unless it somehow relates to you. Any men in my life, I see them for a few weeks and then they're gone. I'm not living a lie, I'm just living my life."
I took a deep breath, trying not to get too worked up before having to go on set and pretend to be a repressed wasp.
"Don't you care that I have to hide?"
"I do," he said. "You know I do."
"Well, then,
but why does your relationship with Celia mean that we should uproot Connor's life and mine?"
"She's the love of my life," I said. "You know that. I want to be with her. It's time for us all to be together again."
"We can't be together again," he said, putting his hand down on the table. "Not all of us." And he walked away. Harry and I were flying home every weekend to be with Connor, and during the weeks we shot, I was with Celia, and he was, well, I didn't know where he was, but he seemed happy, so I didn't question it. I suspected in the back of my mind that he might have met someone who was capable of keeping his interest for more than a few days. So when Teresa's wisdom went 3 weeks over our shooting schedule, because my co-star Ben Madley was hospitalized for exhaustion, I was torn. On the one hand, I wanted to go back to being with my daughter every night. On the other hand, Connor was growing more and more annoyed by me every day. She found her mother to be the very epitome of embarrassment. The fact that I was a world-renowned film star seemed to have absolutely no effect on just how big of an idiot Connor saw me to be. So I was often happier in L.A. with Celia than I was in New York, constantly rejected by my own flesh and blood. But I would have dropped it all in a heartbeat if I thought Connor might want even an evening of my time. The day after filming wrapped, I was packing up some of my things and talking to Connor on the phone, making plans for the next day. "Your father and I are getting on the red eye tonight, so I'll be there when you wake up in the morning," I told her.
"Okay," she said, "cool. I thought we could go to breakfast at Channing's."
"Mom, no one goes to Channing's anymore."
"I hate to break it to you, but if I go to Channing's, Channing's will still be considered cool."
"This is exactly what I'm talking about when I say you're impossible."
"All I'm trying to do is take you to eat French toast, Connie. There are worse things."
There was a knock on the door of a Hollywood Hills bungalow I'd rented. I opened it to see Harry.
"I gotta go, Mom," Connor said. "Karen is coming over. Louisa's making us barbecue meatloaf," she said.
"Wait 1 second," I said. "Your father is here. He wants to say hi to you. Goodbye, honey. I'll see you tomorrow." I handed Harry the phone.
"Hi, little bug."
"Well, she has a point. If your mother shows up somewhere, that does sort of mean that, by definition, it will be considered a hot spot."
"That's fine.
That's fine.
Tomorrow morning, the three of us will go out for breakfast, and we can go to whatever the cool new place is."
"It's called what?"
"Wiffles. What kind of a name is that?"
"Okay, okay, we'll go to Wiffles." All right, honey. Good night. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow.
Harry sat down on my bed and looked at me. Apparently, we are going to Whiffles.
You're like putty in her hands, Harry, I said.
He shrugged. I feel no shame in it. He stood up and poured himself a glass of water while I continued packing.
Listen, I have an idea, he said. As he moved closer to me, I realized he smelled vaguely of liquor.
About what?
About Europe.
Okay, I said.
I had resigned to letting it go until Harry and I were settled back in New York. I assumed that then he and I would have the time and the patience to discuss it in more depth. I thought the idea was good for Connor. New York, as much as I loved it, had become a somewhat dangerous place to live. Crime rates were skyrocketing and drugs were everywhere. We were fairly protected from it on the Upper East Side, but I was still uncomfortable with the idea that Connor was growing up so close to so much chaos. And even more to the point, I was no longer sure that a life where her parents were practically bi-coastal and she was being cared for by Louisa when we were gone was the best thing for her. Yes, we'd be uprooting her, and I knew she'd hate me for making her say goodbye to her friends, but I also knew she would benefit from living in a small town. She'd be better off with a mother who could be around more. And, to be frank, she was getting old enough to read gossip columns and watch entertainment news. Was turning on the television and seeing her mother's sixth divorce really the best thing for a child?
I think I know what to do, Harry said. I sat down on the bed and he sat next to me.
We move here. We move back to Los Angeles.
Harry, I said. And Celia marries a friend of mine.
A friend of yours?
Harry shifts toward me. I've met someone.
What?
We met on the lot. He's working on another production. I thought it was just a casual thing. I think he did, too, but I think this is a man I could see myself with.
I was so happy for him in that moment. I thought you couldn't see yourself with anyone, I said, surprised but pleased.
I couldn't, he said.
And what happened?
Now I can.
I'm thrilled to hear that, Harry. You have no idea.
I'm just not sure this is a good idea. I said, I don't even know this guy.
You don't need to, Harry said. I mean, it's not like I chose Celia. You did, and
I think I'd like to choose him.
I don't want to act anymore, Harry, I said.
All through shooting this last movie, I found myself burning out. I wanted to roll my eyes when asked to do a scene more than once. Hitting my marks felt like running a marathon I'd already run 1,000 times before. So easy, so unchallenging, so uninspiring, that you resent even being asked to lace up your shoes. Maybe if I was getting roles that excited me, maybe if I still felt I had something to prove, I don't know, maybe I would have reacted differently. There are so many women who continue to do incredible work well into their 80s or 90s. Celia was like that. She could have turned in riveting performance after riveting performance forever, because she was always consumed by the work. But my heart wasn't in it. My heart was never in the craft of acting, only in the proving. Proving my power, proving my worth, proving my talent. I'd proved it all.
That's fine, Harry said. You don't have to act anymore.
But if I'm not acting, why would I live in Los Angeles? I want to live somewhere I can be free, where no one will pay attention to me. Do you remember when you were little, and whether it was on your block or a few blocks down, there was inevitably a pair of older ladies who lived together as roommates, and no one asked any questions because nobody cared? I want to be one of those ladies. I can't do that here.
You can't do that anywhere, Harry said. That's the price you pay for who you are.
I don't accept that.
I think it's very possible for me to do that.
Well, I don't want to do that. So what I'm proposing is that you and I remarry, and Celia marries my friend.
We can talk about it later, I said, standing up and taking my toiletry bag to the bathroom.
Evelyn, you don't get to decide what this family does unilaterally.
Who said anything about unilaterally? All I'm saying is that I want to talk about it later. There are a number of options here. We can go to Europe, we can move here, we can stay in New York.
Harry shook his head. He can't move to New York.
I sighed, losing my patience. All the more reason for us to discuss this later.
Harry stood up, as if he was about to give me a piece of his mind, but then he calmed down.
You're right, he said. We can discuss it later.
He came over to me as I was packing my soap and makeup. He took my arm and kissed my temple.
You'll pick me up tonight, he said, at my place? We'll have the whole trip to the airport and the flight to discuss it more. We can throw back a couple of Bloody Marys on the plane.
We will figure this out, I told him. You know that, right? I'm never going to do anything without you. You're my best friend, my family.
I know, he said, and you're mine.
I never thought I could love someone after John. But this guy, Evelyn, I'm falling in love with him. And to know that I could love, that I can.
I know, I said, grabbing his hand and squeezing it.
I know. I promise I'll do whatever I can. I promise you, we will figure this out.
Okay, Harry said, and then he squeezed my hand back and walked out the door. We will figure this out. My driver, who introduced himself as Nick, as I got into the back of the car, picked me up at around 9 in the evening.
To the airport, Nick said.
Actually, we're going to make a stop on the west side first, I said, giving him the address of the home where Harry was staying. As we made our way across town, through the seedy parts of Hollywood, over the Sunset Strip, I found myself depressed about how unseemly Los Angeles had gotten since I'd left. It was similar to Manhattan in that regard. The decades had not been good to it. Harry was talking about raising Connor here, but I couldn't shake the feeling that we needed to leave both big cities for good. As we were stopped at a red light close to Harry's rented home, Nick turned around briefly and smiled at me. He had a square jaw and a crew cut. I could tell he had probably bedded a number of women based on his smile alone.
I'm an actor, he said, just like you.
I smiled politely. Nice work if you can get it.
He nodded.
Got an agent this week, he said as we started moving again. I feel like I'm really on my way, but you know, if we get to the airport with time to spare, I'd be interested in any tips you have for somebody starting out.
Uh-huh, I said, looking out the window.
I decided as we drove up the dark, winding streets of Harry's neighborhood that if Nick asked me again after we got to the airport, I was going to tell him that it's mostly luck.
And that you have to be willing to deny your heritage, to commodify your body, to lie to good people, to sacrifice who you love in the name of what people will think, and to choose the false version of yourself time and time again until you forget who you started out as or why you started doing it to begin with. But just as we pulled around the corner onto Harry's narrow private road, every thought I'd ever had before that moment was erased from my mind. Instead, I was leaning forward, shocked still. In front of us was a car, bent around a fallen tree. The sedan looked as if it had run head-on into the trunk, knocking the tree down on top of it.
Miss Hugo, Nick said.
I see it, I told him, not wanting him to confirm that it was really in front of us, that it wasn't merely an optical illusion.
He pulled over to the side of the road. I heard the scrape of branches on the driver's side of the car as we parked. I froze with my hand on the door handle. Nick jumped out and ran over. I opened my door and put my feet on the ground. Nick stood to the side, trying to see if he could get one of the doors of the crashed car open. But I walked right to the front, by the tree. I looked in through the windshield. And I saw what I had both feared
and yet not truly believed possible. Harry was slumped over the steering wheel. I looked over and saw a younger man in the passenger seat. Everyone sort of assumes that when faced with life and death situations, you will panic. But almost everyone who's actually experienced something like that will tell you that panic is a luxury you cannot afford. In the moment, you act without thinking, doing all you can with the information you have. It's when it's over that you scream and cry and wonder how you got through it. Because most likely, in the case of real trauma, your brain isn't great at making memories. It's almost as if the camera is on, but no one's recording. So afterward, you go to review the tape, and it's all but blank. Here is what I remember. I remember Nick breaking open Harry's car door. I remember helping to pull Harry out. I remember thinking that we shouldn't move Harry because we could paralyze him. But I also remember thinking that I couldn't possibly stand by and allow Harry to stay there, slumped on the wheel like that. I remember holding Harry in my arms as he bled. I remember the deep gash in his eyebrow, the way the blood coated half his face in thick, rust red. I remember seeing the cut from where the seat belt had sliced the lower side of his neck. I remember two of his teeth being in his lap. I remember rocking him back and forth. I remember saying, "Stay with me, Harry. Stay with me. Stay true blue." I remember the other man on the road next to me. I remember Nick telling me he was dead. I remember thinking that no one who looked like that could be alive. I remember Harry's right eye opening. I remember the way it inflated me with hope, the way the white of his eye looked so bright against the deep red of the blood. I remember how his breath and even his skin smelled like bourbon. I remember how startling the realization was. Once I knew Harry might live, I knew what had to be done. It wasn't his car. No one knew he was here. I had to get him to the hospital, and I had to make sure no one found out he'd been driving. I couldn't let him go to jail. What if they tried him for vehicular manslaughter? I couldn't let my daughter find out her father had been driving drunk and killed someone, had killed his lover, had killed the man who he said was showing him he could love again. I enlisted Nick to help me get Harry into our car. I made him help me put the other man back into the totaled sedan, this time in the driver's seat. And then I quickly grabbed a scarf from my bag and wiped the steering wheel clean, wiped the blood, wiped the seat belt. I erased all traces of Harry. And then we took Harry to the hospital. There, blood-stained and crying, I called the police from a payphone and reported the accident. When I hung up the phone, I turned and saw Nick sitting in the waiting room, blood on his chest, his arms, even some on his neck. I walked over to him. He stood up. "You should go home," I said. He nodded, still in shock. "Can you get yourself home? Do you want me to call you a ride?" "I don't know," he said. "I'll call you a cab then." I grabbed my purse. I pulled out 2 20s from my wallet. "This should be enough to get you there." "Okay," he said. "You're going to go home, and you're going to forget everything that happened, everything you saw." "What did we do?" he said. How could we? "You're going to call me," I said. "I'll get a room at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Call me there tomorrow, first thing in the morning. You're not going to talk to anyone else between now and then, do you hear me?" "Yes." "Not your mother or your friends or even the cab driver. Do you have a girlfriend?" He shook his head. "A roommate?" He nodded. "You tell them that you found a man on the street and you brought him to the hospital, okay? That's all you tell them, and you only tell them if they ask." "Okay." He nodded. I called him a cab and waited with him until it arrived. I put him in the back seat.
"What are you going to do first thing tomorrow?" I asked him through the rolled-down window.
"I'm going to call you."
"Good," I said. "If you can't sleep, think. Think about what you need. What you need from me as a thank you for what you did."
He nodded and the cab zoomed off. People were staring at me. Evelyn Hugo in a pantsuit covered in blood. I was afraid paparazzi would be there any minute. I went inside. I talked my way into borrowing some scrubs and being given a private room to wait in. I threw my clothes away. When a man from the hospital staff asked me for a statement about what happened to Harry, I said, "How much will it take for you to leave me alone?" I was relieved when the dollar figure he came up with was less than what I had in my purse. Just after midnight, a doctor came into the room and told me that Harry's femoral artery had been severed. He had lost too much blood. For a brief moment, I wondered if I should go get my old clothes, if I could give some of his blood back to him, if it worked like that. But I was distracted by the next words out of the doctor's mouth. "He will not make it." I started gasping for air as I realized that Harry, my Harry, was going to die. "Would you like to say goodbye?" He was unconscious in the bed when I walked into the room. He looked paler than normal, but they had cleaned him up a bit. There was no longer blood everywhere. I could see his handsome face. "He doesn't have long," the doctor said, "but we can give you a moment." I did not have the luxury of panic. So I got into the bed with him. I held his hand even though it felt limp. Maybe I should have been mad at him for getting behind the wheel of a car when he'd been drinking. But I couldn't ever get very mad at Harry. I knew he was always doing the very best he could with the pain he felt at any given moment. And this, however tragic, had been the best he could do. I put my forehead to his and said, "I want you to stay, Harry. We need you, me and Connor." I grabbed his hand tighter. "But if you have to go, then go. Go if it hurts. Go if it's time. Just go knowing you are loved, that I will never forget you, that you will live in everything Connor and I do. Go knowing I love you purely, Harry, that you were an amazing father. Go knowing I told you all my secrets, because you were my best friend." Harry died an hour later. After he was gone, I had the devastating luxury of panic. In the morning, a few hours after I'd checked into the hotel, I woke up to a phone call. My eyes were swollen from crying and my throat hurt. The pillow was still stained with tears. I was pretty sure I'd only slept for an hour, maybe less. "Hello," I said. "It's Nick." "Nick?
Your driver."
"Oh," I said, "yes, hi."
"I know what I want," he said. His voice was confident. Its strength scared me. I felt so weak right then, but I knew it had been my idea for this call to happen. I had set up the nature of it. "Tell me what you want to keep you quiet," was what I had said without saying it. "I want you to make me famous," he said. And when he did, the very last shred of affection I had for stardom drained out of me. "Do you realize the full extent of what you're asking?" I said. "If you're a celebrity, last night will be dangerous for you, too."
"That's not a problem," he said.
I sighed, disappointed. "Okay," I said, resigned. "I can get you parts. The rest is up to you."
"That's fine. That's all I need."
I asked him his agent's name, and I got off the phone. I made two phone calls. One was to my own agent, telling him to poach Nick from his guy. The second was to a man with the highest-grossing action movie in the country. It was about a police chief in his late 50s who defeats Russian spies on the day he's supposed to retire.
"Don," I said when he answered the phone.
"Evelyn, what can I do for you?"
"I need you to hire a friend of mine in your next movie,
the biggest part you can get him. Okay, he said, you got it.
He did not ask me why. He did not ask me if I was okay.
We had been through enough together for him to know better.
I simply gave him Nick's name, and I got off the phone.
After I set the phone back in the cradle, I bawled and I howled. I gripped the sheets. I missed the only man I'd ever loved with any lasting meaning. My heart ached in my chest when I thought about telling Connor, when I thought about trying to live a day without him, when I thought of a world without Harry Cameron. It was Harry who created me, who powered me, who loved me unconditionally, who gave me a family and a daughter. So I bellowed in my hotel room. I opened the windows and I screamed out into the open air. I let my tears soak everything in sight. If I had been in a better frame of mind, I might have marveled at just how opportunistic Nick was, how aggressive. In my younger years, I might have been impressed. Harry most certainly would have said he had guts. Plenty of people can make something out of being in the right place at the right time, but Nick somehow turned being in the wrong place at the wrong time into a career. Then again, I might be giving that moment too much credit in Nick's own story. He changed his name, cut his hair, and went on to do very, very big things. And something tells me that even if he had never run into me, he would have made it happen all on his own. I guess what I'm saying is, it's not all luck. It's luck and being a son of a bitch. Harry taught me that.
Now this. February 28, 1989. Producer Harry Cameron has died. Harry Cameron, prolific producer and one-time husband of Evelyn Hugo, died of an aneurysm over the weekend in Los Angeles. He was 58 years old. The independent producer, formerly a Sunset Studios mogul, was known for shepherding some of Hollywood's greatest films, including the 50s classics To Be With You and Little Women, and some of the most exciting films of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, such as 1981's All for Us. He had just rapped on the upcoming Teresa's Wisdom. Cameron was known for his keen taste and kind but firm demeanor. Hollywood has been left heartbroken with the loss of one of its favorites. Harry was an actor's producer, said a former colleague. If he picked up a project, you knew you wanted to be involved. Cameron is survived by his teenage daughter with Evelyn Hugo, Connor Cameron. Now this. September 4th, 1989. Wild Child. Blind Item. Which precious Hollywood progeny was caught with her pants down? And we mean that literally. This daughter of former A++ list actress has been having a rough time, and it appears that instead of lying low, she's going wild. We hear that at the age of 14, this wild child has been MIA from her prestigious high school and is often seen out at one of New York's various high-profile clubs, at which she's rarely, sober. We're not just talking alcohol, either. There seems to be some powder under your nose there. Apparently, her mother has been trying to get a handle on the situation, but things hit the fan when Wild Child was caught with two fellow students in bed.
6 months after Harry died, I knew I had no choice but to get Connor out of town. I had tried everything else. I was attentive and nurturing. I tried to get her into therapy. I talked with her about her father. She, unlike the rest of the world, knew he had been in a car accident. And she understood why something like that needed to be delicately handled. But I knew it only compounded her stress. I tried to get her to open up to me, but nothing was helping me get her to make better choices. She was 14 years old and had lost her father with the same swiftness and heartbreak
with which I had lost my mother so many years before. I had to take care of my child. I had to do something. My instinct was to move her away from the spotlight, away from people willing to sell her drugs, willing to take advantage of her pain. I needed to bring her someplace where I could watch her, where I could protect her. She needed to process and heal, and she could not do that with the life I had made for us. "Aldiz," Celia said. We were talking on the phone. I had not seen her in months, but we talked every night. Celia helped ground me, helped me to keep moving forward. Most nights, as I lay in bed speaking to Celia on the phone, I could speak of nothing but my daughter's pain. And when I could speak of something different, it was my own pain. I was just starting to come out of it, to see a light at the end of the tunnel, when Celia suggested Aldiz. "Where's that?" I asked. "It's on the southern coast of Spain. It's a small city. I've talked to Robert. He has a call into some friends he knows in Malaga, which isn't too far. He's going to ask about any English language schools. It's mostly a fishing village. I don't get the impression anyone will care about us." "It's quiet?" I asked. "I think so," she said. "I think Connor would have to really go out of her way to find trouble." "That seems to be her M.O., I said. "You'll be there for her. I'll be around. Robert will be there. We will make sure she's okay. We will make sure she's supported, that she has people to talk to, that she makes the right types of friends." I knew that moving to Spain would mean losing Luisa. She had already moved with us from L.A. to New York. She wouldn't want to uproot her life again to move to Spain. But I also knew she had been taking care of our family for decades and was tired. I got the impression that our leaving the United States would be just the excuse she needed to move on. I would make sure she was taken care of. And anyway, I was ready to take a more hands-on approach to maintaining my home. I wanted to be the kind of person who made dinner, who scrubbed a toilet, who was available to my daughter at all times. "Are any of your movies big in Spain?" I asked. "Nothing recently," Celia said. "Yours?" "Just Bout en Train," I said, "so no." "Do you really think you'll be able to handle this?" "No," I said, even before I knew what Celia was specifically talking about. "Which part do you mean?" "Insignificance." I laughed. "Oh, God," I said, "yes, that's about the only part I am ready for." When the plans were finalized, when I knew what school Connor would go to, what houses we were going to buy, how we were going to live, I walked into Connor's room and sat down on her bed. She was wearing a Duran Duran t-shirt and faded jeans. Her blonde hair was teased at the crown. She was still grounded from when I had caught her having a threesome, so she had no choice but to sit there with a sour face and listen as I spoke. I told her I was retiring from acting. I told her we were moving to Spain. I told her I thought she and I would be happier living with good people, away from all the fame and the cameras. And then I very gently, very tentatively, told her that I was in love with Celia. I told her I was going to marry Robert, and I explained why, succinctly and clearly. I did not treat her like a child. I spoke to her as an adult. I finally gave her the truth. My truth. I did not tell her about Harry, about how long I had been with Celia, or anything that she didn't need to know. Those things would come in time. But I told her what she deserved to understand. And when I was done, I said, "I'm ready to hear everything you have to say. I'm ready to answer any questions at all. Let's have a discussion about this." But all she did was shrug her shoulders. "I don't care, Mom," she said, sitting on her bed with her back against the wall. "I really don't. You can love whoever. Marry anybody. You can make me live wherever. Go to whatever school you decide. I don't care, okay? I just don't care. All I want is to be left alone, so just Leave my room, please. If you can do that, then the rest of it, I don't care. I looked at her, stared right into her eyes, and ached for her aching. With her blonde hair and her face thinning out, I was starting to fear that she looked more like me than Harry. Sure, conventionally speaking, she would be more attractive if she looked like me, but she should look like Harry. The world should give us that. All right, I said, I will leave you alone for now. I got up, I gave her some space. I packed up our things, I hired movers, I made plans with Celia and Robert. 2 days before we left New York, I walked into her bedroom and said, I'll give you your freedom in Aldiz. You can choose your own room. I'll make sure you can come back here to visit some of your friends. I'll do whatever I can to make life easier for you, but I need 2 things. What? She said. Her voice sounded disinterested, but she was looking at me. She was talking to me. Dinner together every night. Mom, I'm giving you a lot of leeway here, a lot of trust. All I'm asking for is 2 things. One is dinner every night. But it's non-negotiable. You only have 3 more years until you're in college anyway. You can handle 1 meal a day. She looked away from me. Fine. What's the second? You're going to see a psychologist. At least for a little while. You've been through too much. We all have. You need to start talking to someone. When I had tried this before, months earlier, I was too weak with her. I let her tell me no. I wasn't going to do that this time. I was stronger now. I could be a better mother. Maybe she could detect it in my voice because she didn't try to fight me. She just said, okay, whatever. I hugged her and kissed the top of her head, and just when I was going to let go, she wrapped her arms around me and hugged me back.
Evelyn's eyes are wet. They have been for some time. She stands up and grabs a tissue from across the room. She's such a spectacular woman, by which I mean she herself is a spectacle. But she's also deeply, deeply human. And it is simply impossible for me in this moment to remain objective. Against all journalistic integrity, I simply care about her too much not to be moved by her pain, not to feel for all she has felt. It must be so hard, what you're doing, telling your story, with so much frankness. I just want you to know that I admire you for it.
Don't say that, Evelyn says. Okay, just do me a favor, and don't say anything like that. I know who I am. By tomorrow, you will too.
You keep saying that, but we're all flawed. Do you really believe your past redemption?
She ignores me. She looks out the window without even looking at me. Evelyn, I say, do you honestly? She cuts me off and she looks back at me. You agreed not to press. We'll be done soon enough and you won't be left wondering about anything. I look at her skeptically. Really? She says. This is one thing on which you can trust me.
Agreeable Robert Jameson.
Now this. January 8th, 1990. Evelyn Hugo marries for the 7th time. Evelyn Hugo got married this past Saturday to financier Robert Jameson. While this is the 7th trip down the aisle for Evelyn, it is the 1st for Robert. If his name sounds familiar, it might be because Evelyn isn't the only member of Hollywood royalty he's linked to. Jameson is an older brother of Celia St. James. Sources say the two met at a party of Celia's just 2 months ago. They have been falling head over heels in love since. The ceremony took place at the Beverly Hills courthouse. Evelyn wore a cream-colored suit. Robert looked dapper in pinstripes. Evelyn's daughter with the late Harry Cameron, Connor Cameron, was the maid of honor. Shortly thereafter, the 3 left on a trip to Spain. We can only assume they are off to visit Celia, who just recently bought property off the southern coast.
Connor came back to life on the rocky beaches of Aldis. It was slow but steady, like a seed sprouting. She liked playing Scrabble with Celia. As she'd promised, she ate dinner with me every night, sometimes even coming down to the kitchen early to help me make tortillas from scratch or my mother's caldo gallego. But it was Robert she gravitated toward. Tall and broad, with a gentle beer belly and silver hair, Robert had no idea what to do with a teenage girl at first. I think he was intimidated by her. He was unsure what to say. So he gave her space, maybe even more of a wide berth. It was Connor who reached out, who asked him to teach her how to play poker, asked him to tell her about finance, asked him if he wanted to go fishing. He never replaced Harry. No one could. But he did ease the pain, a little bit. She asked his opinion about boys. She took the time to find him the perfect sweater on his birthday. He painted her bedroom for her. He made her favorite barbecue ribs on the weekends. And slowly, Connor began to trust that the world was a reasonably safe place to open your heart to. I knew the wounds of losing her father would never truly heal. That scar tissue was forming all through her high school years. But I saw her stop partying. I saw her start getting A's and B's. And then when she got into Stanford, I looked at her and realized I had a daughter with 2 feet placed firmly on the ground and her head squarely on her shoulders. Celia, Robert, and I took Connor out for dinner the night before she and I left to take her to school. We were at a tiny restaurant on the water. Robert had bought her a present and wrapped it. It was a poker set. He said, "Take everybody's money like you've been taking mine with all those flushes." "And then you can help me invest it," she said with devilish glee. "Atta girl," he said. Robert always claimed that he married me because he would do anything for Celia. But I think he did it, in at least some small part, because it gave him a chance to have a family. He was never going to settle down with one woman, and Spanish women proved to be just as enchanted by him as American ones had been. But this system, this family, was one he could be a part of, and I think he knew that when he signed up. Or maybe Robert merely stumbled into something that worked for him, unsure what he wanted until he had it. Some people are lucky like that. Me, I've always gone after what I wanted with everything in me. Others fall into happiness. Sometimes I wish I was like them. I'm sure sometimes they wish they were like me. With Connor back in the United States, coming home only during school breaks, Celia and I had more time with each other than we ever had before. We did not have film shoots or gossip columns to worry about. We were almost never recognized. And if people did recognize one of us, they mostly steered clear and kept it to themselves. There in Spain, I had the life I truly wanted. I felt at peace, again waking up every day seeing Celia's hair fanned on my pillow. I cherished every moment we had to ourselves, every second I spent with my arms around her. Our bedroom had an oversized balcony that looked out onto the ocean. Often the breeze from the water would rush into our room at night. We would sit out there on lazy mornings, reading the newspaper together, our fingers gray from the ink. I even started speaking Spanish again. At first I did it because it was necessary. There were so many people we needed to converse with, and I was the only one truly prepared to do it. But I think the necessity of it was good for me, because I couldn't worry too much about feeling insecure. I simply had to get through the transaction. And then, over time, I found myself proud of how easily it came to me. The dialect was different. The Cuban Spanish of my youth was not a perfect match for the Castilian of Spain, but years without the words had not erased many of them from my mind. I would often speak Spanish even at home, making Celia and Robert piece together what I was saying from their own limited knowledge. I loved sharing it with them. I loved being able to show a part of myself that I had long buried. I was happy to find that when I dug it up, that part was still there, waiting for me. But of course, no matter how perfect the days seemed, there was one ache looming over us night after night. Celia was not well. Her health was deteriorating. She did not have much time. "I know I shouldn't," Celia said to me one night as we lay together in the dark, neither of us yet sleeping. "But sometimes I get so mad at us for all the years we lost, for all the time we wasted." I grabbed her hand. "I know," I said, "me too." "If you love someone enough, you should be able to overcome anything," she said. "And we have always loved each other so much, more than I ever thought I could be loved, more than I ever thought I could love. So why? Why couldn't we overcome it?" "We did," I said, turning toward her. "We're here." She shook her head. "But the years," she said. "We're stubborn," I said, "and we weren't exactly given the tools to succeed. We're both used to being the one who calls the shots. We both have a tendency to think the world revolves around us." "And we've had to hide that we're gay," she said. "Or rather, I'm gay, you're bisexual." I smiled in the dark and squeezed her hand. "The world hasn't made that easy," she said. I think both of us wanted more than was realistic. I'm sure we could have made it work, the two of us, in a small town. You could have been a teacher, I could have been a nurse. We could have made it easier on ourselves that way. I could feel Celia shaking her head next to me. "But that's not who we are. That's not who we have ever been or could ever be." I nodded. "I think being yourself, your true, entire self, is always going to feel like you're swimming upstream." "Yeah," she said. "But if the last few years with you have been any indication, I think it also feels like taking your bra off at the end of the day." I laughed. "I love you," I said. "Don't ever leave me." But when she said, "I love you too, I never will," we both knew she was making a promise she couldn't keep. I couldn't stand the thought of losing her again, losing her in a deeper way than I'd ever lost her before. I couldn't bear the idea that I would be forever without her, with no tie to her. "Will you marry me?" I said. She laughed, and I stopped her. "I'm not kidding. I want to marry you, for once and for all. Don't I deserve that? 7 marriages in, shouldn't I finally get to marry the love of my life?" "I don't think it works that way, sweetheart," she said. "And need I remind you I'd be stealing my brother's wife?" "I'm serious, Celia." "So am I, Evelyn. There's no way for us to marry. All a marriage is a promise." "If you say so," she said, "you're the expert." "Let's get married right here and now, me and you, in this bed. You don't even have to put on a white nightgown." "What are you talking about?" "I'm talking about a spiritual promise between the two of us for the rest of our lives." When Celia didn't say anything, I knew that she was thinking about it. She was thinking about whether it could mean anything, the two of us there in that bed. "Here's what we'll do," I said, trying to convince her. "We will look each other in the eye, and we will hold hands, and we will say what's in our hearts, and we will promise to be there for each other. We don't need any government documents or witnesses or religious approval. It doesn't matter that I'm already legally married, because we both know that when I was marrying Robert, I was doing it to be with you. We don't need anybody else's rules. We just need each other." She was quiet. She sighed, and then she said, "Okay, I'm in." "Really?" I was surprised at just how meaningful this moment was becoming. "Yeah," she said. "I want to marry you. I've always wanted to marry you. It never occurred to me that we could. that we didn't need anyone's approval. We don't, I said. Then I do. I laughed and sat up in our bed. I turned on the light on my nightstand.